I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. While Abraham Lincoln's political accomplishments have been well explored by historians, tragedy in his personal life is the focus of George Saunders' latest novel. Lincoln in the Bardo explores the president's grief about the death of his youngest son and imagines his resilience in the face of loss. Today we talk with Saunders, whose book earned the 2017 Man Booker Prize for Fiction, about his remarkable life of writing. But first, a recent deportation case in Lawrence received national attention. We talked to a local immigration attorney about the situation and about what faces those who overstay their visas. We'll get you up to date after the news. The case of Syed Ahmed Jamal, the Bangladeshi man living in Lawrence who was taken into custody by Immigration and Customs Enforcement late last month, has got attention and raised protests around the country and indeed the world. The latest development came yesterday as an immigration judge ordered a stay of removal just as the university instructor was already on his way to a detention center in Texas. Presumably his next stop would have been out of the country, maybe forever. He remains in custody today, but could well still be sent out of the country soon. Jamal's story is not unique and offers us a chance to explore some of the immigration laws that come into play in cases like these. Here to help us with all this is Jonathan Wilmoth. He's owner of Wilmoth Immigration Law here in Kansas City. He's also an adjunct professor of law here at UMKC. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. And I want to start by talking about how Jamal came here in the first place and how many immigrants come. He came here legally on a visa.
Yeah, so There's a large array of visas available to people to come to the United States for temporary periods. That could be for school, for work. It could even be where they're investing in a new business. But those things are temporary. They have end dates. And if you stay past the period of time that you're given, then you're subject to being removed or deported from the country.
And so there's quite an array of kinds of visas that people come here on. I assume they all come with different laws, different regulations, how long you can stay on each one.
Absolutely, yeah. A student is admitted for a pretty wide open period of time as long as they're continuing to maintain their class load and to otherwise comply with the visa. Workers are for 3 years. They can extend it for another 3 years. Each one has a series of regulations that describe what they can do on that visa and how long it's they're able to keep it and to maintain it going forward.
And I understand that Mr. Jamal, like many others, came in with one kind of visa but ended up changing to another one.
It's permitted to change your status from one visa category to another, provided that you file that application timely, which means you don't wait until after the first one expires to file the second one. There are a bunch of rules there, including that you're not allowed to work without authorization, that you maintain the initial visa status, you continue doing the things you're supposed to do on it all the way up until the time that you're changing your status. So any problems that you have there can be really detrimental to you going forward. So you may file a change of status and 9 months, 10 months later, find out that it's been denied well after the period that you were originally given has expired.
So you did the right thing by applying for this new kind of visa or this extension, but it's too late now.
It may be too late by the time you get a decision on it.
And I know where you keep talking about Mr. Jamal. I know that he is not your client, but
no.
Your firm has spoken with him.
We have, and I'm familiar with the process that he's going through because we've gone through it with other people.
Right.
And I did hear about the stay of removal that was granted. It's a temporary stay while the Department of Homeland Security files their response to his attorney's motion. And then the judge will make a decision on the motion.
How unusual is that he got this stay? Because there were a lot of folks that were pretty anxious that we were counting down the hours before he was going to be deported, and then the stay was issued.
It's I would say the equities in his case are such that the stay makes some sense.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he doesn't really have any criminal history. He's got U.S. citizen family members, and he's been here for a really long time. So those are all and his experience, his work experience, and his community involvement are all things that as they've been reported, they're all things that weigh in his favor. So mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that a judge would stay his removal on those bases. However, where we see stays of removal being argued successfully is generally where someone didn't have notice of their prior deportation hearings. Like they were going about their lives and all of a sudden they found out, oh, by the way, I have a deportation order I didn't know about.
Yeah.
That's one. Another is where a prior attorney committed malpractice. And so you've alleged malpractice, you submit evidence of how you were negatively impacted and maybe didn't even discover it until well after you'd been ordered deported. Those are two scenarios where we see motions to reopen granted more regularly. This one, I would say, is not a regular case where we would see a stay granted, but mm-hmm. maybe the equities in his case were such that the judge was willing to grant it.
Having said that, it's only a temporary stay. It's something like 10 days, I believe. Does it necessarily indicate that the outcome is likely to be any different?
It doesn't indicate the outcome one way or the other, in my opinion. The judge is staying the removal until the department can respond. So the motion was filed by Mr. Jamal's terrific attorney, and the Department of Homeland Security gets 10 days to file a response. And they asked for him to be allowed to remain in the United States during those 10 days and presumably for however long it takes a judge to make a decision after that.
That's Jonathan Wilmoth. He's an immigration attorney. We're talking today on KCUR's Up to Date about the immigration cases in the news and the way that immigration law is being enforced right now, which is a little bit different under the Trump administration. If you have questions for our immigration law expert, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCUR. Up to date. You know, Jonathan, a question that a lot of people are asking is why would anyone, as Mr. Jamal did, overstay their visa? You know that it's a temporary grant. You know that it's going to come to an end. What are some of the reasons people stay? You did mention that some people do actually apply for a different kind of visa and just don't hear back in time. But why else do people overstay?
There are a whole variety of reasons. It could be family. They've been married. They've been divorced. They've had kids. It could be that after they came to the United States, something happened in their home country that has caused them to fear going back. It could be that their financial situation or any other things that have changed have created a situation where they really just cannot comply with the strict orders of the visa.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's sort of a suspicion almost among a lot of Americans who look at these applications for visas for a variety of things, student, work, and think that what the person really just wants to do is stay in the country indefinitely, but are using the visa process to do that.
The Department of State takes the position that anyone applying for a non-immigrant visa at a U.S. embassy has what they consider to be immigrant intent. That means that they intend to really come to the U.S. and never leave.
So that's just the assumption, even if they're applying for a non-immigrant
visa. That's correct. And they have to rebut that. They have to show that they do actually have the intent to go back to their home country. So for students or workers, some working visas, they're allowed to have that intent, but some they're not. And for any visas where they're required to show their non-immigrant intent, they have to show ties to their home country. That could be employment, family, could be bank accounts, properties, things like that that show that they are going to go back eventually.
So a non-immigrant visa would be for, you mentioned students and work potentially, but what else could it be?
There are non-immigrant programs called J visas where people come in for you think of like au pairs coming in for the summer, mm-hmm. Or for just international exchange programs. There are employment visas for artists, for soccer players and things like that. There are visas for people who they have a business abroad and they want to open a new store, a new part of that business in the United States. there's a visa for that. There's a visa for people who are from certain countries where we have trade treaties and they want to come to the U.S. to establish trade between the two countries. There are quite a few visas, and all of them have their own unique regulations.
So one of the really interesting things about this Jamal case, it was news to me anyway, was this program called Orders of Supervision. So the Department of Homeland Security allowed Jamal to stay in the country even though he had overstayed the visa, even though he was here actually illegally, but he even would check in with them regularly. How does that work?
So an order of supervision is something where the Department of Homeland Security says, okay, you have an order of removal from the United States, but for whatever reason, we either can't or don't want to enforce it at this point. Some countries won't accept people back. They won't issue them travel documents to return to their country. And my understanding was Bangladesh was one of them and that maybe now that's changed. But in any event, if you have a situation where they really can't or won't send someone back, they'll give them an order of supervision where they go in to their office and check in once a year. In the beginning, it's usually every few weeks or every few months, and then once a year, and show that they're not getting arrested and they're continuing to comply with those orders.
And in this case, was that the occasion where Mr. Jamal's fortunes began to change?
From what I read, it appeared to be that he was picked up at his home, which is a little bit different. What we've seen on most of our order of supervision cases this year, so beginning in about middle of 2017 to today, are people that have orders of supervision maybe for several years. When they go in for this year's checkup, they're being detained. And so they maybe have been complying for years and years, and they're not sort of told, hey, be ready when you come in to be put on a plane, and they're just being detained.
And that seems like a terribly frightening experience for the people involved and probably for their families as well.
Well, you're expecting, just like every time for the last 7 or 8 years you've gone in, you know, you've complied with what they wanted. And now this time you're not home when your kids get home from school. You're in jail and they don't know if they're going to see you again or when they're going to see you again. So, yeah, I would definitely agree that it is frightening for their families.
Are orders of protection of this, or supervision rather, orders of supervision being granted anymore under the Trump administration? Or are people still being told you can stay here illegally as long as you check in?
There may be some around the country, I don't know. But the pattern that we've seen is that they're not being issued, and that people who had them previously are having them revoked. We're seeing that sort of repeatedly.
So what do you do about that as an immigration attorney? What are you saying to your clients? Is there really anything they can do about that other than keep going in, checking in, and hoping you don't get arrested?
There are a few things. If their underlying deportation order had some problem with it, and my understanding is that the attorneys for Mr. Jamal have filed a motion, and part of it was based on problems with the original order. And so if you've got problems with that order, you can file motions to reopen. You can affirmatively get that prepared, file it with the court, and try to fight your case in the court. You may have some new fear of going back, in which case you can request something called a credible fear interview, where you would get an interview with an asylum officer. The downside of that is that you do that from jail. So when you get taken in and you're detained and you request that credible fear interview, you wait there in the jail until such time as an asylum officer issues a decision on your case.
Which obviously you're not in your best position to be making complicated legal arguments.
No, and you wouldn't happen to have evidence in your pocket when you get arrested. But if it's the kind of thing where you know I've got to check in a few months and you've been hearing from family members back home about some change in their circumstances, you could begin assembling that evidence to have it ready for such a request.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners. You can join the conversation, too, if you have questions about immigration law, from our legal expert, Jonathan Wilmoth. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Let's talk to John in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well, thanks.
I have a really good friend of mine whose husband is from Kenya. He came over here on a student visa to go to KU, was a track star at KU, and graduated there. And graduating, went to work, and he works in-home for disabled people. And went to transfer his student visa to a work visa, but it missed his deadline by a week, not realizing such. So in so doing, got into the system and went back and forth to court, had gotten married in the process to my friend who's a citizen, and spent years trying to get transferred to a work visa so he could be on a work visa. And while trying to do so, his father got sick in Kenya, so he went to Kenya to take care of his father, who has since died, but they won't even let him back in the country, and she hasn't seen her husband in 3 years. What can we do about that? How can we get it so that he can come back?
Jonathan Wilmoth is doing a lot of nodding with a resigned look on his face as he hears this story.
No. It sounds like he potentially violated his visa status by not filing on time. However, he entered as a student, so it's possible he doesn't actually have any unlawful presence. If he has a U.S. citizen spouse who filed a petition for him, there is a waiver available for any unlawful for having unlawful presence for more than a year if he did. There is a permission to return after an order of deportation, both of which he can apply for based on hardship to his spouse. I don't know what that hardship would be without, you know, knowing all the facts, but that is the way that you would attack that case, is to see what is the hardship to her based on the separation from him, and then you would file the waivers. They're filed here in the U.S., but it's to be sent to the U.S. Embassy for him to then be issued the immigrant visa to come back to the U.S.
John, I have to think that your friend's wife would say it is a hardship to not have your husband in the country for 3 years.
Beyond that, he was the breadwinner. She's a manager at a storage unit falling apart because she's got no money because he worked and he was the breadwinner while she took care of the house. And
yeah,
so that would be the hardship right there.
John, thanks so much for calling and asking that question.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I want to ask you, Jonathan, one of the terms we've heard about in the past week a lot is prosecutorial discretion. Under the Obama administration, there was a conscious decision, a ruling, a directive given to prosecutors around the country to not pursue every case. To what extent were immigrants relying on that, and how has that changed in the past year?
They were relying on it a lot. It was a memo that was issued that said if people didn't have significant criminal history, if they didn't have sort of repeated immigration violations, they had just entered once and stayed here for too long, that they would not then be target for removal, that their cases would be administratively closed, and they would just kind of go into a limbo status for the foreseeable future. We are seeing now the Department of Homeland Security reopening those cases that they had granted prosecutorial discretion on, regardless of whether or not there was any change. So it's not based just on a new criminal issue or something like that. They just – now everybody's a target, so they're reopening them.
But is everybody a target? I mean,
yeah.
Everybody is a potential target, but is everybody going to be essentially rounded up?
Yeah. I mean, I think it will take a very long time, but that is the agenda. So you've got two competing interests. On the one hand, the administration talks about wanting to reduce the backlog in the immigration courts. And on the other hand, they're refusing to prioritize criminals over non-criminals. So now the judges have to hear everybody's cases. And so they're getting more backed up instead of less, because we aren't getting the non-criminals cases pushed aside for the time being, like we were before.
So the Syed Jamal case, while it has attracted a lot of attention, and this is a sympathetic figure because people know him as a professor or instructor, the reality is this is going to be a very typical case.
Yes, it's my expectation that anyone who's had prior contacts with immigration will be having their cases reopened if they were administratively closed. If someone has a contact with immigration now, they will not just sort of push it aside. They're going to begin removal proceedings against them, regardless of their criminal history.
I'm curious, Jonathan, where do your own clients tend to be from?
All over. We have a lot of clients from Mexico and Central America who are applying for asylum or family-based immigration, but we also have clients from India and China, from several countries in Africa and even a few European and Canadian clients as well.
And is there any word of comfort or assurance or legal legal comfort that you are able to give them at this point?
It depends. Everybody's case is different. So there are people where what we're planning on is for, okay, how do we deal with this in the future? For if you are removed, how do we apply for something that will get you back into the country? There are a variety of things that we're looking at for everybody. There are plenty of cases where we are advising that at this point, there isn't much that can be done, and they may want, you know, they need to begin making plans for what they're going to do in the future if they have to be relocated.
Would you advise them to leave voluntarily?
I don't advise one way or the other. Just like I don't advise people to enter the country without authorization in the first place, I don't advise them to overstay their visas either. But what we try to do is to say, if you've overstayed and if there's this potential problem that you're going to have with immigration, how do you make plans going forward with the expectation that this administration will continue against them?
That's Jonathan Wilmoth. He's an immigration attorney and owner of Wilmoth Immigration Law here in Kansas City. Jonathan, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
He wrote what many say was the best novel of last year. Next week, he's coming to Kansas City to talk about it. But ahead after the break, George Saunders is talking to us about Lincoln in the Bardo and a life of writing. Stick around. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we learned about Buffalo Soldiers and the local group that's preserving their legacy. You can catch that conversation and all our other programs at kcur.org/up-to-date. Join us next week. Musicians from the Folk Alliance will tell us what it's like to make a living as a contemporary folk musician. That's next week on Up to Date. Today, if you're going to do something at all, you really should do it well. A year ago, George Saunders tried his hand at releasing his first novel. And that novel, Lincoln at the Bardo, won the Man Booker Prize, given to the best novel in English each year. But that's just the latest year in a career filled with success, especially as a short story writer, winning numerous awards and fellowships and also popular success. George Saunders will be in Kansas City next week speaking at a library event, but we have the chance to talk with him a bit today. He joins us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. George Saunders, welcome to Up to Date.
It's nice to be here. Thanks.
It's really great to have you. And you've written in Lincoln at the Bardo a beautiful and strange book. It's a meditation on the grief of Abraham Lincoln in 1862 at the death of his 11-year-old son, told through the eyes of an eerie and often profane cast of characters. I know you've said you didn't necessarily set out to write a novel when you started writing this book, but at some point it compelled you to keep writing. How is this what emerged?
Well, I was really trying not to write. When I'd had a long history of, getting about 80 pages into things and going, I did it, I wrote a novel, and then shrink it, it ended up shrinking down to 10 or 15. So I was looking pretty suspiciously at this one. And it was just kind of the kind of thing where I got about 70 pages I liked, and I was only, a quarter of the way through the story. So I thought, maybe this will be it. My history has been that if I just try to keep stuff really short and fast, it works out better. So this was a surprise to me too, for sure.
It is a unique kind of narrative. It's not written in just a standard sort of third-person omniscient author story. I know how I would talk about it, but how do you describe this book to people? What is the style in which this novel's written?
Well, when you look at it, really, it looks like a play, essentially. The one difference is that the attributions of the characters comes at the bottom of the text instead of the top.
Right.
And then once you get into it, you'll see that it's kind of more, it's a little dense for a play. The speeches are long and they're pretty involved, but really visually it looks like a play. My wife's been kind of kidding me because there's a lot of white space in it. So she said, that's actually how you write a novel. You put in a lot of hard returns. But
I did read it faster than I read most 325 page books. I will say that.
Yeah, it kind of pulls you through. But I think part of the idea was I didn't want to do, as you said, a kind of conventional third person. Abraham Lincoln walked into the frosty graveyard late one evening, and as I was working on it, there were the story is narrated by ghosts, and I love the idea of kind of just essentially giving the ghosts their own microphones. Just what do you have to say, and letting them narrate it. you know, my experience of writing books is you have to be excited by the material. You have to be excited by the approach. If you're not, nobody else is going to be. So as soon as I hit on that approach of a kind of theatrical presentation, this kind of ghostly Greek chorus, I just was excited to try it. And for me, that's usually the green light.
And yet different than a play, the ghosts are not merely telling their own story. Sometimes they are telling you what the other ghosts did or said.
Right. It turned out to be, I didn't plan it this way, but it turned out to be a really interesting, flexible way of narrating, because you can look in the distant past, you can look into the present. It turns out the ghosts can enter into living people and kind of read their minds. So as a narrative machine, it was really kind of fun to stumble on that and see, you know, as you write a book, you're sort of making rules and then trying to see what the rules require of you and then also what they permit you to do. So that was a pretty fun experiment.
Well, and holding all of those elements together is part of what has made the book so widely called unique. I read something from an interview that you gave before the book was finished, actually, where you told the reporter you were working on a book that was going to be historical, but also close to science fiction. Do you feel like that's a good description of what emerged?
Exactly right. Yeah. You know, actually, I was writing an email to that writer, Lemony Snicket, who's a friend, and I, about halfway through, I said, you know, man, I think I'm either doing the best work I've ever done or a real career ender. And he wrote back, don't forget, it could be both.
Like great authors of the past. Is history something that you've always been interested in? Are you surprised that here you are writing a novel and it turns out to be a historical novel?
Yeah, I guess I've kind of been interested in this sort of average, you know, level. I've never had used it in my fiction very much at all. And to be honest, I was kind of, you know, trying not to use it in this one. I avoided writing this book for about 20 years because I knew there'd be a significant history component. And it just, you know, your fear as a writer is that you get into some material that you can't make come alive. And that's the case with that. So really one of the big challenges of this was to do justice to the history, try to stay basically, you know, faithful to the history and still make it have the energy and the pop of a kind of contemporary novel. So that was kind of one of the reasons that form developed, is just to, you know, some of this material, it's very sad material, first of all, and it's potentially pretty dry. So the game was to kind of convey the information without slowing the pace down.
And yet some of the most interesting words in the book, no offense, are words that you didn't write. You've taken historical snippets of actual historians or even contemporary sources from Lincoln's day and woven those in. It's not just the ghosts that do the talking.
Right. I felt that I really needed some historical grounding in order to kind of justify these ghosts. And, you know, I tried doing it kind of Gore Vidal style and making some third-person history, and it just didn't have the authority that I wanted. So one day I just thought to myself, can I just put these in verbatim? You know, is that plagiarism? I said, no, it's not actually, it's sampling, you know. And at some point I'm like, well, it's my book, I can do whatever I like. And the kind of big moment was when I had written this one scene, quote-unquote written, I'd done it by sampling. And you could see that depending on how you arrange those, it was either dull or exciting. So I'm like, well, maybe you could imagine that a writer also can be kind of a curator of other people's stuff. So that then introduced a really kind of exciting, a little bit forbidden, you know, angle.
It is really quite the cast of characters in the novel, and obviously some of them are based on, or some of them are actual historical figures like Lincoln and his son Willie, but the other characters are quite a menagerie. Are they based on real people as well out of history, or totally sprung up out of your mind?
Mostly out of my mind. The ghosts were just kind of, you know, it's a strange process because I didn't really have a plan on which ghosts would be in the book or when, and you just kind of show up in the morning and you're like, okay, who wants to say something, you know? Or you're having Lincoln walk across a certain part of the graveyard and you just imagine kind of looking left and looking right and seeing who's around. And of course, all the ghosts are coming from the writer's subconscious in some way. And they're also each designed to serve some particular function of the book. So in this one, this particular graveyard, is the idea is that there's nobody happy who's a ghost here. If you're a high functioning person who's pleased with your life and you're a good person, you just go right to heaven, or, you know, you could go to hell. But these are all ghosts who sort of got halfway out the door and decided they weren't ready to be dead yet.
Which gets to the title of the book, the bardo, which is not a word I knew until I read what you've said about it.
Yeah, it's sort of like Buddhist purgatory, and the difference is, you know, in the Catholic purgatory that I grew up in Chicago, that was kind of like the DMV. You know, you go sit on a hard bench until the end of all time. This Bardo is a little more negotiable. You know, if these ghosts can realize that they're dead and come to some kind of peace with whatever was bothering them about their lives, then they're allowed to go on. But some of them have been here for 100 years. You know, they have an unhappy love affair or just a real fondness for their life on Earth, and they can't seem to, you know, get out the door on the other side.
And actively discourage others from doing so.
Yeah, they think it's very cowardly. You know, they think they're kind of sort of an elite class who's been able to sustain their life in slavery. They look down on anybody who goes on to the other side.
So this this particular technique, this gadget in your book, allows you, because these ghosts can enter into living human beings, allows you get into the psyche, especially of President Lincoln. Lincoln has sometimes been called America's saint of sorrow. He is a person whose psyche has attracted a lot of attention. How did his private life influence what you know about it, influence your thinking about this book?
Well, one of the fun things about Lincoln is we don't actually know as much as we think we do. You know, there's a really kind of light record of things he actually wrote.
He died before he could write any memoirs.
Exactly right, yeah. So in some ways, I guess that allows the writer to project onto him a little bit. I think he was, a pretty sad guy, pretty heavy bouts of depression, and he would rouse himself out of them with jokes and with telling these kind of bawdy stories and so on. So for me, the exciting thing was to sort of try to, you know, find out who he was. But when you're writing a novel, one of the things is you sort of can play some tricks. I mean, for example, I was really working hard to keep him off stage as much as possible. Almost like, you know, if you shine a bright light on somebody in a costume, you'd say, he's just dressed up like Lincoln. Mm-hmm. So part of the thing is to keep him out of the light a little bit. And then the other thing that helped was to say, you know, I don't have to really know everything about Lincoln. I'm not writing the life story of Lincoln. But I do need to know, you know, where his head was at 11:59. Where was he standing? How cold was he? You know, you had to sort of know him for 2 minutes, and you knew where he'd just come from, and you knew where he was going. So that kind of helped a little bit. It's a very intimidating thing to write a book about a guy, you know, that 30,000 books have already been written about.
Yeah.
I thought, in the end, I felt like he was, you know, I actually think he is kind of a saint in the sense that when you do a lot of reading about him, it feels like towards the end of his life, he got quite selfless. You know, he was looking pretty bad as president, even towards the end. But he would always kind of make the decision that would move the thing forward. He would let other people take the glory. He was happy to be a little bit humiliated if he had to be to get the job done. And I thought there was something really wonderful about the last couple of years of his life, the way that he was receding and this other kind of presence was sort of stepping into his shoes a little bit.
The book, of course, focuses on a particular moment in his life, a particular night, really, where his son, his 11-year-old son, Willie, has died. And he is the cemetery where we meet all these ghosts is where his son has just been buried and where he goes to spend some time. Why do you think this moment was the one that you wanted to illuminate? What is it about this moment of profound grief that you think makes for a story to tell?
Yeah, I'll tell you the honest answer. I don't know. The only thing was I heard this story about 20 years ago. We were just driving past the graveyard, and my wife's cousin mentioned it. And I thought, oh, that's cool. And it just stayed with me. There wasn't a month that went by where I didn't think, God, that Lincoln story is so beautiful. So that's really why. You know, what I've learned over the years is if an idea refuses to go away, you actually don't have to know why it's interesting to you. You just know that it's almost like somebody who keeps asking you out on a date or something, you know, there must be something there, or else they're a stalker, I don't know. But you know, in this case, it just felt to me, every time I would get happy, like if I'd finish another project, something would go right, my mind would go, oh, how about that Lincoln thing, you know? And for many years, I put it off because it did seem so straight, you know, I'm mostly a funny writer, try to be. And it just seems so kind of, you know, tragic and grief-filled and on the nose. And then only it was, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, I kind of thought, man, I'm 52 or whatever it was. you know, if I can't take on this heavy emotional material now, I never will be. And that's a shame. You know, a writer should be able to, you know, to take on the heavier aspects of life and the more earnest aspects of life. So I kind of just wrote myself a 6-month contract to try it and said, well, you know, if you get to the end of the 6 months and it's no good, you can just throw it away and never told anybody you did it.
It is, of course, a very serious book and a book about grief and transformation and transcendence, but it is also at times very funny. I mean, the writer that you know yourself to be does come through, and it's also sometimes pretty profane. For a bunch of ghosts, there's a lot of sexual situations and bad words. How difficult is it to hold all of that together in a story that still feels serious?
Well, for me, the main thing is to say, what is life like? You know, is life tragic? Yes. Is life profane? Yes. Do people make, you know, pass wind at funerals? They do. Mm-hmm. So if you just say the ghost world is just our world, with maybe a little bit fewer constraints, you know, a little higher energy, a little weirder. I mean, another way of saying that is, you know, we know that there can be very sad moments of incredible loss. We've all experienced them, unfortunately. But we also know that those don't negate the beautiful, funny, even silly moments that we have. So in literature, we often divide those up in comedy and tragedy. But from your actual life, you know that they overlap even in the same moment. So for me, the Watchword is, well, you know, it's a sad story for Lincoln and his son. It might not be such a sad story for somebody who's standing 10 feet away. They might be preoccupied with their own stuff. So my goal has always been to try to make as full a portrait of life as possible. And, you know, that means everything can go in. And if there's a funny juxtaposition when you put, you know, the funny versus the tragic, that actually just means that we maybe don't look at life as unblinded away as we should. You know, there's always that juxtaposition in real life. We organize it otherwise maybe to comfort ourselves, but yeah. You know, I felt like in the ghost world that, you know, all things are allowed, basically.
We're talking with George Saunders, author of Lincoln at the Bardo and many other books. He's going to be coming to Kansas City next week. Rainy Day Books and the Kansas City Public Library will have him at the Plaza branch of the library on Thursday, February 15th. That's at 6:30 p.m. The event's free, but registration's required at kclibrary.org. You're listening to Up to Date here on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. George, a lot has happened in the year since this novel was released, not least of which is that it won the Man Booker Prize, which is the highest honor, probably, an English language novel can receive each year. That's quite a reception for your first novel. Have you been surprised at how this work has been received?
Oh, yeah, really surprised and, you know, gratified. And my wife keeps me down to earth because she's like, I'm not sure that's a novel. You know, there is a lot of white space. But no, it's been a really nice surprise. And it was not something I really had sort of given up. I didn't care if I wrote a novel. I had plenty of fun with short stories. But I was happy that I finally got to tell this particular story that had been in my mind all those years. And if it took this sort of weird format and a novel to do it, then I'm pretty pleased.
Are you hooked on the form? Is this are there going to be more novels from George Saunders?
I hope so, but I learned a long time ago that it works best if I just say I have no idea what this thing I'm writing is going to be. If it wants to be longer, it'll tell me. And if I do the other thing where I say, I'll write an 800-page novel about this or that, I always end up sort of being disappointed with the result. I think a story has a natural energy and also a natural stride and a natural kind of DNA. So it really knows how long it needs to be to feel new and essential and compressed. Mm-hmm. So the writer is best to just sort of sit back and say, what do you want to do? You tell me. I'm not the boss of you. You're the boss of me.
Yeah. You wrote this book before the 2016 presidential election. I wonder, would the political climate, how it stands today, influence the book if you were to sit down and write it now? Does it matter who the president is now for the way you thought about the president then?
No, I'm glad actually that it didn't, because I'm, you know, like a lot of people, it's really on my mind and I'm really sick about what's happening. That I just happen to be, you know, a liberal left of Gandhi, but I don't like it. The blessing was that I could write this in a political vacuum and just concentrate on the human story. I think if I wrote it now, you know, everybody has Trump on the brain, no matter, I mean, you could be shopping and he's on your brain. You know, it's almost like it's too much, actually, I think. So I was happy that the book was done before any of this happened. But then, you know, I when I had finished it, I was kind of on a like an artistic buzz, you know, and I just wanted to do something. So the New Yorker sent me to the on the Trump campaign, and I went to five or six rallies, and it was really kind of striking. You know, one thing just to see the way that my mind when I was writing a novel was one thing. It was kind of happy a lot of the times and pretty generous and pretty curious and really, really comfortable with ambiguity, you know. And then you go on the campaign trail and it's so agitating and people were so aggressive. And, you know, to write a story like that, you kind of have to lower yourself into social media and cable news and all that. Mm-hmm. And I just noticed the way my mind was working differently. You know, all of a sudden I was kind of snippy and angry. I wasn't sleeping as well. Was always getting into these cheap arguments with people that I probably otherwise would have liked and all that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so I think that's an interesting thing about the kind of.
Okay. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, that is interesting. I wonder, too, just with any book, regardless of the topic, does the way you think about a particular piece of your work change over time? Do you really think about it at all after you've written it?
Sure, I do. I mean, I'm always kind of trying to figure out what I did right and if I connected with people. And, you know, going out on the road is a good way to find that out. So in this book, it was the gratifying thing was to see that even though I'd kind of taken a wild swing at it, you know, I wasn't sure it was going to work until I was almost done. It was really cool to see, to be out on the road and hear people really having a positive emotional response to it. That was huge. So the effect is that you kind of go, all right, so as weird as this book was, it's working for some people. So I can maybe even push it a little further the next time.
You are maybe the only novelist whose professional life began as a field geophysicist, according to your official bio.
No, I hung up.
Does it matter to your history as a writer that you really were not always a writer? Are you still there, George?
I'm calling him back. Oh.
Well, we
yeah, sorry.
We can hear George, but we can't. But I don't think he can hear us.
Hello.
Are you there, George? So I believe we're about to reestablish the connection.
Hello.
And we're talking with George Saunders, the author of Lincoln at the Bardo. George, are you there with us now, George?
I am. I'm sorry about that. We got cut off.
Great. It's good to have you back. The question I asked was about your own history. You are maybe the only novelist whose professional life began as a field geophysicist.
I think maybe.
How much of that history affects who you are as a writer, that you did some things besides writing?
Yeah, I think the main thing was that I
went to this place called the School of Mines in Colorado, and it's a really rigorous technical school, you know, the kind of place where they say, look to your left, look to your right, you know, two of you are flunking out. And they were big on what they called no partial credit. So, you know, if you got into the fifth page of a proof and made a mistake, you got 0 points. So that, you know, that ethic actually really helps you in writing, where if you are writing a book for 6 years and it's still stupid, you know, there's no excuses. So I got kind of used to a very kind of binary ethic of rigor. And then the other thing that was nice was that job or that degree got me out into the world traveling. So mm-hmm. I went to Asia and kind of, you know, just got a little smarter about the way the actual world is and the way poverty and privilege works and all that kind of stuff. So I was really happy I went that way.
Yeah, even after you were established as a writer, I mean, you've now been an established writer for a very long time. Back in 2006, you got both a Guggenheim Fellowship and a MacArthur Genius Grant. Talk about rising stars. That's 12 years ago. How has your life changed since then? Do you feel like you've matured or aged in the manner of a fine wine or somehow actually changed?
Age in the manner of a Boone's Farm wine. No, you know, really what's happened is I think, you know, my life has been, I mean, really has been good all along, but the last, in career terms, it's been really wonderful. And I think what happens then is you have to keep reminding yourself that just because things are going well for you doesn't mean that misery has vanished from the world, especially if you're a writer. You know, you don't want to get this feeling that, you know, all the bad things that you used to know don't exist anymore. So I've been trying. The main thing I do is I try to go on the road with nonfiction pieces into places that aren't so nice, just to remind myself that you know, fiction is still for, as I used to say, comforting the oppressed and oppressing the comfortable. So in some ways, you have to do kind of a reverse brainwashing on yourself to say that good luck for me doesn't mean that, you know, bad luck is vanished.
Yeah, one of the interesting honors you've been given is a few years ago, Time magazine said you were one of the world's most influential people, one of the 100 most influential people. I guess I'm curious what your response to that was. Do you think of yourself as influential? And if so, how does a short story writer and a novelist exert influence?
I don't think I'm very influential. You know, I mean, usually if I can get the garbage to the street on time, that's pretty good.
Well, it's something.
I thought that was a nice honor. And you know, more than likely, there are four or five young writers at Time magazine who decided to throw it in there. But I think fiction can influence the world just in the sense that it teaches the writer and the reader that specificity matters, and that if we're going to have the goal of being more compassionate, more present in the world, that really starts by trying to think about an individual person at an individual time, and maybe putting aside our natural inclination to conceptualize broadly and make big statements about groups, which is what a lot of political life and certainly a lot of social media-based political life does. There are big concepts thrown around, and we tend to forget that there are individual people in the crosshairs. Fiction, I think, one of the many things it can do is it can just remind us that there actually isn't such a thing as an undocumented immigrant. There's just Jim, you know. And if you could talk to him and if you could interact with him, you would have more options in your response. It's also true that there's no such thing as a Trump supporter. There's only Larry, you know, and you talk to him. And it doesn't mean you have to be a pushover, but it means that whatever you do, you're doing it with a more substantial database, essentially. So I think that's something that I get out of writing fiction anyway. It's just a sense of power, because I realize that the world only occurs a minute at a time with certain individuals in front of me. And that makes me feel more in control of my responses.
That's George Saunders, the great American writer, author most recently of Lincoln at the Bardo, but always working on more short stories. At least we hope so. George Saunders, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
If you missed any of today's conversation, including our earlier conversation about immigration law or yesterday's look at the Farm Bill, you can find all of that in podcast form at kcur.org/up-to-date. Our theme music was composed by Bobby Watson. Don't forget, you can find us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date, and I'm at ptsbrian. We had help this week from Linda Scherer, Michael Byers, Chris Pruitt, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Steve Kraske's back on Monday. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date. Thank you.